Hello, I'm Fontone Quinlivan, CEO of Futura Health, welcoming you to Workforce RX, where I interview leaders and innovators for insights into creating a future-ready workforce. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Patricia Cuff of the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine to the podcast to gather her insights on the current and future state in the education of healthcare providers. As Forum Director of the National Academies Global Forum on Innovation in Health Professional Education, Dr. Cuff helps lead an ongoing conversation with academic experts and practitioners that evaluates promising innovations across the learning continuum from education to practice. Dr. Cuff also contributes her own research to the field and is currently coordinating workshops on the future of pharmacy education and practice and the affordability of health professional education. Thanks very much for joining us today, Patricia.
Thanks so much, Vaughn. It's really terrific to be here, and I really appreciate the invitation.
Absolutely. Well, let's start by having you share about your work at the Global Forum on Innovation and Health Professional Education.
Super. Yeah. So I kind of chuckle when I get this question to tell me about the forum, because it's a question that my mother has been asking me repeatedly for over a decade now. And I think the easiest way to explain it is basically I bring people together. I bring people together who are passionate about providing the best healthcare possible to patients and populations, as well as those who are passionate about educating the care providers, the next generation of care providers, as well as the current health workforce, but also educating the faculty themselves. So what we do at the forum is we provide a platform for our 50 members to come together. They represent 16 different health professions. So we have medicine, nursing, but we also have dentistry, social work, mental health counseling, optometry, a whole host of other health professions represented on the forum. They are educators. They could be faculty, deans, provost. We also have accreditors on the forum, as well as administrators of health professional and education associations. But also, the members are not just educators, they're also practitioners. So not only are they educating, but they're also providing care. So a lot of our conversation is this space, the bridge between education and practice. Now, I did say that our main focus is to bring people together. And the way we do that is we have small groups that come together across professions to incubate ideas and to take those ideas and to come together to plan our workshops that the members themselves agree upon the topics. So all of our workshops are free. They're open to the public. They're in person. They're also virtual, so we can expand our reach to reach as many as possible. And some of them are actually extremely popular. We've gotten 900 to over 1,000 registrants to some of our workshops. And it won't surprise you that recently we ran a workshop on artificial intelligence, which was really one of our most popular workshops. And when we were preparing for the workshop, we spoke with someone from, he was actually an educator in an engineering school. And this is kind of an interesting story that he developed a chatbot and told the students in his class that the chatbot was the TA and her name was Rachel. And so the students were to use the TAs if they had questions. And so at the end of the class, he sent out an assessment and how did you like the different TAs? Well, actually, Rachel scored very well. Among the students, she was responsive at all hours of every day. She was consistent and she never got upset, even if they asked the same question multiple times. So actually, at the end of the class, the students really wanted to nominate her for actually an award for being one of the best TAs, which everyone thought was funny. But the idea being that the educators have to educate the current health workforce, of course, as well as the learners about AI. But also AI can be used as a tool for the faculty themselves to be able to help lighten their load a little bit. So I'll just say that one other very popular topic was meeting the needs of an aging population. Now, that topic, I think, is critically important. I just want to call out because of the demographics that are happening. We have more people reaching 100 years of age and older, and we really need a health workforce that understands the needs of an aging population. I just want to emphasize one last point, and I promise I'll pause, is that it's the members themselves that decide upon the topics. So they really have their ear to the ground, and they can understand what are the critical issues facing education and healthcare workforce today. So that's kind of the forum in a nutshell.
The two examples that you mentioned are super interesting. And of course, they've come up on my radar even just this last week, both the AI topic and its application into learning and healthcare, as well as meeting the needs of the aging population. So when you get 50 stakeholders together in a meeting, my goodness, how do you generate the ideas?
Yeah, well, the ideas are really generated in the small groups, as I had mentioned before. We come together twice a year with just the members. We hold our workshops as well twice a year, but just the members come together and they talk about what's going on the ground. What are the challenges that they're facing and what are the issues that they need to address? And what are those issues that rise to the top that they see as critically important to the work that they do, but also to the work that others do? And so that's why we open our doors and we let others in to see some of the outcomes that take place from these small group meetings.
So you mentioned, for example, the chatbot, which was much more friendly and more patient than maybe the live human being. And you could extrapolate from the student's experience to see how that could be applied in healthcare, for example. What are some of the lessons learned that you would like others to replicate?
As I think about it, you know, imitation is the greatest form of flattery, right? But, you know, I'm not sure that I necessarily want others to replicate or imitate the work that we've done. What I would prefer is for people to build upon the foundation that we've laid. So if I can give an example of that, last year we took this show on the road. We're actually based in DC, but we took the show on the road to Pennsylvania, and we worked with the University of Pennsylvania's Penn Dental Medicine. And the director of the program up there, it's an interprofessional education program that is run by Dr. Mark Wolf. And his focus is providing preventive, good interprofessional oral health care for persons with physical and mental disabilities. And what we found is that really every health professional has a role to play in maintaining good oral health and has an advantage to working with patients who have good oral health. So, for example, the nutritionists have a role in maintaining good oral health by monitoring the diet and making sure that there aren't too many sugary foods being eaten and drinks. The occupational therapist can work with persons with disabilities to try and work with their manual dexterity and come up with toothbrushes so they can brush their own teeth. And then something that I discovered, which I hadn't heard before, is dentophobia. And that's actually a fear of dentists. And so that's something that the psychologists have actually been working with. Also to kind of bring this together with the whole notion of interprofessional, which is different health professions working together, we uncovered the fact that the health records for medicine do not communicate with the health records of dentists. They're inoperable. So even if the dentists and the medical directors wanted and the doctors wanted to work together, they actually would not be able to interact using their medical records. And then if you also think about it, if you ever have a toothache and you go to the hospital, they really can't do very much for you. There's no interaction between medicine and dentistry. Now, we did hear about, this is the workshop that we ran up in Pennsylvania. We did hear about a dental hygienist in Oregon, a small hospital in Oregon. And while the hospital isn't paying for her, she does have funds to be able to support her position part-time, and she has done an incredible job in being able to facilitate the interaction between the mouth and the body. The whole idea that the mouth is not part of the body is ridiculous. It's we talked about mind, mouth, body, and soul. She was able to help one patient in particular who was an elderly woman who wasn't eating post-operative, and they really needed to get her to start eating so they could discharge her. And what she found out was the reason this woman wasn't eating was because she had pain in her mouth. She had a toothache. And so she was able to help with that, alleviate the pain, get her eating, get them out of the hospital, and give her a referral to the dentist. So I just wanted to say that these are the sorts of things that we're addressing. And so it's a sort of long-winded way of getting to your question. I guess if there was one item that I would like to be replicated, it would probably be our truly interprofessional approach that we take on the forum, where all the health professions have value, everyone has a voice on the forum, and everyone's considered an important part of the team. And I just will point out that this is actually quite rare in education as well as healthcare, where everything tends to be much more siloed.
This is a good point. I had not heard of the word interprofessional until I chaired the California Healthcare Workforce Education and Training Council. So this is this word actually is so unique to the healthcare arena. And I'm wondering if by having the stakeholders, your members be as diverse as they are from different disciplines, does that allow them to solve problems differently or see a problem space differently?
Yeah, I think that puts it really nicely, that when you get into a silo, you see things very myopically, and it's hard to think outside of the box. And I think that what this does is it allows the different health professions to learn from and with each other. And that's really the whole notion behind interprofessional. It's learning from and with other health professions. So, for example, ideally, what we're doing is we're educating interprofessionally so that when going into practice, the students now know how to collaborate with other health professions. Actually, let me give you an example. I'm dealing with a lot of examples, but I think it helps to bring to life the idea that, let's say you're running a clinic and you have a patient who comes in who's overweight and has diabetes. So ideally, the team will collaborate around this patient towards a goal that will benefit the patient. So for example, the pharmacist or the medical doctor might be in charge of the person's medicines. The dietitian would be in charge of the patient's diet. The exercise therapist would then come in and work with the patient's activity level. And if they need social services, we could have a social worker or a caseworker. And then there could also be a nurse or a physician assistant who would then manage the care and monitor the vitals and sort of manage the whole case. And so the idea is like kind of like a baseball team in a sense, that everybody has a position on the team. Nobody stands out as being, you know, more important than the other. It's non-hierarchical, but everybody has to come together for the benefit of that patient and really work towards a common goal to be able to have the best care for that patient. And, you know, it's not uncommon that you might go in to see one health professional and then you go to another and they ask you the same questions. You go to another, they ask you the same questions. So the idea is, how do we work together with the patients? And I will just say that this is actually quite rare to see this sort of interprofessional collaborative practice. What is more likely, because studies have been shown, that people think they're working interprofessionally, but when you actually look at them and monitor them, what you find is they're working next to each other. So it's something that if you think of back to, you know, the childhood 2-year-olds, they don't play together. They have parallel play. And that's how it's been described in the workplace, that often the care providers are working, but they're working side by side, not interacting, or they're educating their learners, sitting one right next to the other from different health professions. But unless you have them interacting and working towards a common goal, you're not truly interprofessional. So what I would like is for people to really understand the importance of working together towards that common goal.
And Patricia, maybe for all the listeners who are not from healthcare or even higher education and healthcare, the interprofessional approach is a means towards an end, right? And I was wondering, what is the end, the intended end of working interprofessionally?
What a great question. So I would say, and I think others would agree with me, that the goal is really depends upon the person, the patient themselves. So when we talk about an elderly population, we don't always have the same goals in mind as we would with someone who's quite young and vibrant and has the whole world in front of them. Their aim may be, if they have a particular disease, it may be, let's hit it hard, give me every medicine you've got, I'm going to fight this thing, I'm going to get over this. As we get older, the desire may be less focused on giving me the best, the strongest medication so I can hopefully beat this thing. It may be more towards, if you can make it so that I feel well enough to take care of my grandkids, that's what I really want in my life. So understanding what it is that the person themselves wants, what is that person's goal? What do they want out of their life? And have the team form around those goals. I think that is really the essence of interprofessional. That really the team leader is the patient or the person, as opposed to someone who's a healthcare provider, especially because many healthcare providers have been trained to try to treat every disease to the ultimate and regardless of the side effects of the medication, just try to extend the life of the person, which for some people, that's exactly the right goal. But for other people, the goal may be different. So that's how I see interprofessional.
So Patricia, tying it back to your prior comment, the topic for the Global Forum was meeting the need of aging populations. In my head, I automatically jumped to like dealing with chronic diseases, but you're not talking about just that. I mean, based on your explanation just now, it's about a bit more of a patient-centered approach, team-based care. I actually am loving all your examples. So are there some other examples of how you might slice and dice this topic of meeting the needs of the aging population?
Yes. Funny you should say that. So someone has just recently joined my forum, and this is a spinoff on the workshop that we ran on meeting the needs of an aging population. And one of the things that we uncovered through that workshop is that aging begins really the moment you're born. And some people on that workshop planning committee wanted to say, well, it begins in utero. And that was kind of a step too far for me. But I do believe that it does begin in childhood, because the decisions that you make in childhood are going to affect you as you get older. And you may not feel the impacts when you're in your 20s and your 30s, but as you get into your 40s, 50s, 60s, those decisions that you make as a young person actually impact what you're able to do, be it chronic conditions. Most typically we think of chronic conditions, but it's really the foundation that you lay as a child and a young person, those that are laid down for you. Do you exercise? Do you eat healthy foods? And those can really come back to haunt you as you get older. So the way I look at it, and what we're setting up now, is we're setting up a working group, again, one of these small groups that we're putting together, to focus more on healthy aging. Because I think this is really going to be the narrative of the future, that we're going to be looking towards not so much treating disease and trying to treat every disease that comes along, but to try to prevent those diseases from occurring in the first place, prevent those bone breakages that could be avoided if the diet was well maintained and exercise and so forth. So the way I see it, meeting the needs of an aging population, is not only understanding what it is that the person themselves wants out of their life, but also looking at aging across the lifespan, across the life course of a person.
So pulling on that thread, that doesn't necessarily, and what you hope to do is also prevent that person from needing to go in and seeing the doctor. And maybe there are different kinds of healthcare workers, or maybe they're not even healthcare workers, that do the work on prevention, I would imagine. So if you had a crystal ball on where the future would go with regards to the care workforce associated with healthy aging, tell us what your thoughts would be.
Yeah, so let me look into my magic eight ball and think about this. Where do I think it's going? Well, I think we have to start in the present, because right now we do not have an adequate health workforce to take care of the needs of the current aging population. We just don't have it for a variety of reasons. It's not a major that a lot of healthcare professionals want to go into. One of the things that we learned is that even if the courses are offered for the learners, quite often they don't take them. It's just not seen as prestigious. It's not seen as cutting edge. And so I think what we need to do is we need to start thinking about the current health workforce, because what happens is the graduates, the learners don't see the value in it and don't pursue any education in it. And by not having the education, it's not uncommon that the courses get dropped. So you don't even have the education. And then what happens is the learners graduate, the students graduate, and now they're in the health workforce and they suddenly realize, oh, actually 80% of my population that I take care of are older adults. And I never learned how to care for an older adult, which is quite different. It's more complex. It has more social issues. And as I said before, it's not always what you learned in school as the best treatment that's the best option. It's really what the person wants. And quite often it takes more time to work with that person. So what we need to do is we need to educate the current health workforce to be able to take care of the aging population. And maybe we need to require that all learners understand how to take care of an older population, similar to what we do in pediatrics. Pediatrics is often required in all of the majors, but geriatrics is not. And so trying to see if it's possible to include that as part of the accreditation process, I think would go a long way to forcing learners to understand that they're going to be taking care of older populations. You need to understand their unique needs, but also you need to understand how to work with them as a unique population.
Well, certainly when you look at the demographics of America and the aging and the growth of the 65 plus population, you are right. We need to get ready for the geriatric care much more so. So when it comes to the interprofessional approach, are there some institutions or organizations that do that kind of upskilling that you've talked about particularly well?
Yeah, there is. There's a group through the VA that actually has done a really terrific job. They've put together an educational program that was really meant just for the VA. But what they found was that and this is how we uncovered that it was such a need. She said that people are calling me constantly to provide them the educational materials that they've developed. And so she was very surprised that this wasn't learned earlier on in the education, that she was having to provide so much education to people after they've gotten into the health workforce. So I think that's very telling there, that this is a gap in healthcare providers as well as education that I think really does need to be addressed.
You are also coordinating a workshop on the affordability of health professional education. What are you learning through that body of work?
So we've run 3 pre-workshops already. The workshop itself is taking place at the end of April. The first pre-session that we ran was looking at, is cost a barrier to entering into the health professions? So that was our first question that we asked. And basically what we uncovered was that yes, no, maybe. It really depends upon the health profession itself. And that means that some of the health professions have a very strong return on investment, whereas others actually are demonstrating a weak return on investment. And by that, I mean students have to take out loans in order to pay for their education. And does the salary compensate for the amount of money they have to take out in those loans? Now, I will say across the board, pretty much all the health professions have to get a bachelor's degree. Now, what we've seen is that most, if not all, are now requiring a master's as well as a doctorate degree. And what happens there is not only does the student often take out a loan for the bachelor's degree, but they have to take out even more of a loan to get the master's and the doctorate. And what we uncovered in the first pre-workshop that we ran was that as the requirement increases for the higher level education, the lower the return on investment for entering into that health profession. And that's actually very telling, as many of the health professions are having what they're calling a degree creep, where they're requiring higher and higher levels of education. But are the graduates being compensated? Are they able to pay off their loans after they graduate? Now, as I said, it's really dependent upon the individual health profession. So there are also health professions that actually have a very high long-term earning potential. And it's the ones that you might imagine. There's medicine, dentistry, nursing. Those are the three that really kind of stand out. And they're grappling with different sorts of issues. Like, is cost a barrier for all the potential applicants to come into the health profession? Or is it just those who have the means to be able to get a loan and to be able to have that loan taken out? Now, I will say dentistry is the most expensive of all the health professions. So the graduates end up with a large debt, probably the largest debt of all the health professions. The difference for dentistry, as I said, each is unique, is that within 7 years, they actually pay off their loans. So the return on investment for going into dentistry is actually quite good. But if you were to just assess them the very first year they graduate, it looks awful, that their return on investment looks terrible. And similar with medicine. If you look at that first year when they're doing their residency, their salary is low and their debt is very high. So it looks as though it's a terrible return on investment. But actually, if you look at the long term, it's actually quite a good return on investment. Now, what I'll say about those is that the question kind of comes down to, is cost a barrier to entering into primary health care? That's an area that is diminishing in numbers, and it's a tremendous need for the population around the U.S. and around the globe. But what we're finding is that more and more graduates are going into specialty care and not primary health care. So the question is cost a barrier to going into primary health care? We're exploring that question. Now, with dentistry, it's not a barrier to going into primary health care because 80% of the graduates actually go into primary health care because the return on investment for specializing is not that great for dentistry. So their issue is not going into primary care. Their issue is being able to provide care for the entire population. So what you find are that the dentists are grouped around urban settings. But if you go into a rural community, there are very few dentists available. And that's why I was pointing out that one rural hospital in Oregon that was able to employ a dental hygienist was actually quite impressive. So, and I'll just say one more thing is the nurses, they actually have probably the best return on investment of any of the health professions, because quite often their education is paid for. They can start in the health workforce really at the bachelor's level, at the master's level, the doctorate level, and the salaries are actually quite competitive. So they end up with not too bad of a debt and a decent salary. So what we're seeing is enrollment for medicine, dentistry, and nursing is actually quite strong, whereas some of the other health professions that have a weaker return on investment, their enrollment is in some places a little on the scary side.
On this question of affordability, and let's assume there's some shortages in the primary care workforce, were there some best practices when it came to structuring, for example, loan forgiveness or financial aid such that you could attract or grow your own from your own community?
Such a great point. Absolutely. Yes, loan forgiveness programs work extremely well. The graduate has to be willing to put time in back in service. I think one of the best returns on investment is the military. Now, for medicine, they pay for all of your education and you give back, I believe it's 10 years. Nursing, similarly, where they pay for all of your education and then you've got a service requirement of, it's less than medicine. I think it's something like 7 years. I don't have that exactly right, but it's a lesser commitment. But you put in your commitment and then you're free to re-up with the military, or you can then go into the civilian world. But there's also other programs where you get loan forgiveness by going into serving in rural populations. And that's huge. Now, I will say that one of the challenges in that regard is getting people to stay in the rural populations. And even if they want to stay, these are often quite young people who are starting their lives. And sometimes in a rural population, it doesn't have the infrastructure that they might need, say, for example, to go to put their child into the best schools and have the sorts of resources that they would like to be able to start a family. So those are some of the challenges.
Well, I want to give you a chance to take a look at the future of care and the future of caregivers. And I would love to invite you to impart any last thoughts to our listeners.
I think in the future, one of the key issues that we're going to have to be dealing with is stress and burnout. This is actually one of the, if not the largest issue facing the health workforce today. That what we're doing is we're graduating the eager students who want to join the health workforce, and then we're putting them into a system that emphasizes the business model of healthcare. And in doing that, we're focusing in on the numbers, get them in, get them out. The medical health record is actually not so much a medical health record as a tool for billing. And trying to ask people to do more with less resources at a faster rate is a recipe for burnout and stress. And so I think what we need to do in the future is we really need to get a handle on meeting the needs of the health workforce, in a sense, so that they can get back to providing the sorts of care that they were trained to provide and that they wanted to provide and the reason that they went into the health professions in the first place.
Perhaps we can get some of those bots you mentioned earlier on to do some of this billing paperwork so the joy can be brought back into healthcare.
You know, I think those plans are underway.
Well, Patricia, it was a delight to have you. Thank you, Dr. Cuff, for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Vaughn. I really enjoyed the conversation. We'll talk again soon, I hope.
I hope so as well. I'm Vaughn Tone Quinlivan with Futura Health. Thanks for checking out this episode of Workforce RX. I hope you will join us again as we continue to explore how to create a future-focused workforce in America.